Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, the art historian Aaron Thompson will discuss the politics of public art, a matter brought to national attention in the summer of 2020 when protesters enraged by the murder of George Floyd tore down Civil War memorials and statues of Christopher Columbus. And John Huntington will look at the history of the far right in the U.S. and its often close relationship with the respectable right. First, the politics of public art. During the protests in the summer of 2020 following the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis cop, frequent targets of attack were statues that honored figures that were more deserving of opprobrium, like Robert E. Lee and Christopher Columbus. In the heat of those days, Aaron Thompson, associate professor of art crime at John Jay College of the City University of New York, got famous for advising protesters on the best way to pull down a statue. Use chains, not rope, she said on Twitter. This enraged Tucker Carlson, who denounced her on his Fox News show. She was on Behind the News in July 2020 to discuss the politics of public statuary. And now she's out with a very fine book on the topic, Smashing Statues on the Rise and Fall of Public Monuments, from W.W. Norton. By her count, 170 monuments came down in the wake of Floyd's murder, 80% of them by official, not spontaneous, popular action. We didn't have time to discuss Stone Mountain in Georgia, a disgraceful monument to the Confederacy, whose history is bound up with the Klan, and whose original sculptor was a con artist and thief who then went on to do Mount Rushmore. I apologize for a couple of brief audio dropouts in the interview. Zoom often has a mind of its own. Aaron Thompson. I'm sure you've heard many times people say, they're just statues. What do they really matter? What do they matter?
Statues are things to think with. Right, we put our hopes and dreams about the future of our communities into our public art. They summarize what we think is valuable about the past, and they are meant to inspire ambition to continue this into the future. So it's no wonder that a time when Americans are debating what the future of our nation should look like, we are also debating about monuments. It might seem like just some fruitless discussion about the past, but it's really not. It's a crucial discussion of where we're going, what we honor, who we want to be.
You opened with some tales of this sculptor, Guido, is that how you pronounce his name?
Mm-hmm.
The sculpture of Washington and of this rescue. Interesting stories about early America. What was his vision of Washington and what nerves did it annoy?
Something I really wanted to do with the book was tell these stories of controversies over early American monuments to show that what's happening today is not unprecedented, that we've been fighting about monuments for a long time. So Horatio Greenough was the first American sculpted to make a three-dimensional public monument. Previously, the job of decorating the Capitol had been given to foreign-born sculptors.
I was struck there was a lack of domestic talent in that area at first, right?
Well, if there's not a huge call for sculptures, you can't exactly make your living. So Greenough struggled for a long time. He had to borrow money from his family. He got some loans from James Fenimore Cooper, who was a patron of his. He was trying for years to get a commission to sculpt George Washington because he figured this is going to be the first person that the government is going to spend a lot of money to honor. And he was starting from a blank slate. It's sort of mind-blowing to imagine this coming from nowhere. How do you represent this very particular form of power of the presidency in America? And Greenough is so interesting to me because he totally messed it up. His sculpture was installed in the 1840s and immediately got all sorts of criticism because he used a very neoclassical / ancient Roman model. He showed Washington nude from the waist up, wrapped in a toga, sitting in a chair, but with a very realistic Washington head. So it sort of morphs from superhero pecs to jowls within a couple of inches. And the thing that people wrote about in criticizing it, or even said on the in congressional debates, was this isn't dignified like Washington. He was too cautious of his health to ever appear out in public without his clothes on. He might catch chill. But I think from looking deeper into the discussion, what was really criticized about this statue was that it was un-American. It showed power as if the presidency was conveyed by God, as if you had to be God-like in order to hold it. So there couldn't be any successor through an election to someone who's, you know, appointed by whatever heavenly power. So the sculpture got moved out of the Capitol building pretty soon after it was installed, and then got kicked farther and farther away from the halls of Congress. Actually, now it's in the Smithsonian Museum.
Next to an escalator or something, right?
Next to an escalator, yeah. Sculptures had to represent a power that could be passed down through election. But still, the power that is usually represented in most American public monuments is something that is very much in accord with the people who have actually been in charge of the country. So there are a whole lot of representations of white men as holding power, and not, I think, a lot of room for other people to see themselves as possibly sharing in that power.
And then he did a rescue sculpture, which embodied an awful lot of American mythology.
Yeah, so Greeno's next act, he sculpted a group of a pioneer family being threatened by an indigenous warrior. And it's pretty hilarious because it just shows this super strong, again, he loved to do the muscles, super into the buff representations. So this very strong warrior just sort of crumpling away at the feet of an American pioneer who didn't even really seem to have to exert much force to sweep him out of the way. The sculpture was highly praised when it was installed. Everyone's like, oh yeah, Washington, that was a mess up. But this one, oof, rescue, great. Until about the 1930s, when there started to be protests that it was insulting to Native Americans, as it is indeed. It sets them out as people who used to be strong, but now are just sort of withering away in the face of expansion.
Now, I'm surprised to see that kind of consciousness in the 1930s.
Yeah, me too. But like I said at the beginning, when you have these giant artworks, they really trend to draw abstract ideas and protests to them. So you see people debating these issues about statues, sometimes decades before the question of Native American rights or other sort of rights enters the public consciousness. So that rescue was removed in 1958, and in the 70s, it was being transferred from one storage area to another, and it was dropped accidentally, quote unquote, from a crane. And so now only the dog survives whole. because, of course, the settler family came west with a cute fluffy dog.
Yes, there's a whole great chain of being embodied in this sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the politics of public sculpture, most of what we talk about is Civil War related, though not exclusively, of course, but a lot of it's Civil War related. So what's the timeline of when all these Civil War memorials arose, and what purpose were they serving as they were commissioned and created?
Yeah, it's not accidental that a lot of debates have revolved around Civil War monuments, just because they're the most widespread, especially in the early 20th century. It was the first time that every community had thought, all right, we need to have a monument. And oftentimes, especially in smaller towns, either Confederate Memorial or the Union Memorial remains the only piece of public sculpture in town. But most of these went up pretty far after the close of the war. The first couple of decades were devoted to private mourning, to memorials in cemeteries. And so this idea of what we have now, of the big crowd monument in the city center celebrating the Confederacy or celebrating the Union, really came only from the 1890s on. And that's what gets me really interested thinking about these historically.
This is decades after the war was over.
Yeah. So you have to think, all right, what is the purpose of putting these up at that point? Because so many of the debates about monuments have been about the character of the person honored. Is Robert E. Lee a good role model or not? I don't really care about those debates. I want to know what was the function of this particular hunk of marble or bronze. You know, what role did it play in the community? And for sculptures that went up decades or even almost a century after the close of the Civil War, you got to ask what were they doing? A theory that I have seen around is that these monuments started to go up to intimidate Black voters. But if you look at the timeline, they are mostly go up in the South well after voting rights have effectively been squashed. So they're less about, I think, intimidation than they are about sending a message to white Southerners about maintaining this idea of racial superiority. I found in particular, they often meet up in towns during times of labor disputes when there is a threat of interracial union organization.
Yeah, the story of Birmingham is very interesting in that regard.
Yeah, so the Birmingham Confederate Monument I focused on in the book because it went up in two stages. Each of those stages is very clearly related to mine bosses and managers being like, oh no, we're going to have to pay our workers more if they do manage to unionize. Tell the white workers not to cross racial lines to unite with black workers because that would be betraying their Confederate heritage.
There are a couple of subjects of these monuments. There's a lot that are just ordinary soldiers standing in a peculiar posture. And then, of course, there are ones on, I guess they're disappearing now, but from Monument Avenue in Richmond, which are all about generals. So, yeah, what about these two subjects of these monuments? First of all, what is this characteristic ordinary soldier model? What's that all about?
Yes, so in the news we've been seeing, most of the headlines have been about the top brass, right? The generals on horseback, the huge statues, the very expensive ones. But those are actually the tiny minority of statues. Most Civil War-related monuments are a life-size figure of an unnamed, low-ranking soldier just standing there. And I started to wonder, okay, well, why? If you could have your choice of anybody to honor, why just this dude? I figured out that the pose that this soldier is standing on is known as parade rest. It's not a pose of fighting, of marching, of dying, of anything. No, it's a pose that soldiers stood in when they were listening to instructions during drill. So it's a pose of standing there and listening to your betters, your superiors. So again, no wonder this is the type of sculpture chosen by the upper class to convey a message to the men they thought were their inferiors, to say, keep behaving like your Confederate ancestors by becoming one dedication speech called the glory of the Confederate soldier to be a cog in a wheel. Keep working in your factory. Don't complain. You know, sacrifice for your duty. Expect a better life later, et cetera, et cetera. So I became very interested in this because so much of the defense of these Confederate monuments has been, well, this is my heritage. This is something that respects my family. And I started to think, wait a minute, I don't think these are quite as complimentary as a lot of people think they are.
It's just shut up and obey is the message.
Exactly.
And directed towards controlling the white population,
mm-hmm.
which was a perpetual management problem for the Southern upper class.
Yeah, there are a lot easier ways to intimidate the black population, but it's a lot harder to make white men vote the way you wanted them to. So I think that public monuments were a big part of the management technique.
And then going back to the Birmingham story, the one of the things that frightened the leadership of the city was that black and white reuniting in a labor struggle. And that was the last thing they wanted, right?
Exactly.
I'm speaking with the art historian Aaron Thompson, author of Smashing Statues, just out from W.W. Norton. The monument, this is Birmingham, right? It happened in two phases.
Yes.
They put up half of it and then didn't complete it till a second labor struggle came up?
Exactly. They put up the base, then they raised funds for the base in just a matter of weeks, and then that labor struggle was defeated, and then they just left the base empty for a number of years until another threat of unionization arose, and they're like, okay, now we must finish it off.
And this all happened around, 40 years after the end of the war, so...
The city of Birmingham wasn't founded until 1871, well after the close of the war. So it was celebrating a Confederate past the city didn't even have in order to achieve a contemporary purpose.
And then, of course, the other monuments, the ones that have attracted so much attention, Robert E. Lee and the other generals. What was the context for those?
So those varied. One of the most fascinating context that I found during my research was for the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, which was, of course, the focal point of the 2017 Unite the Right rally. It was put up in 1924 after a few years of fundraising and a really heavy discussion of the design in the Charlottesville newspapers, in exactly the same year that Virginia passed its Racial Integrity Act, which outlawed interracial marriage and allowed for sterilization of quote-unquote unfit people, both of which laws were intended to prevent the, again, severe, quote unquote, dilution of the white race with interracial children. And Lee was crucial in this debate, right? He had been dead, long dead, but he was discussed as the example of what happens when you have, quote unquote, pure white race. Yeah, it will flower into someone with the gentlemanly characteristics of Lee. So what seems like it's a hearkening back to the 19th century was actually very much a product of contemporary 19 teens and 20s eugenics theory put into a public forum to convince, again, the local audience, not just to pass these laws, but to follow them, to not marry anyone without checking into their racial heritage, et cetera, et cetera.
Thomas Jefferson didn't necessarily follow that advice, but still.
Exactly.
Now, something I didn't really think about much before was that there are many of these Union monuments in the North. I had a friend in college who, when he got to New Haven, said, he grew up in Louisiana, got to New Haven, said, where's the Civil War Memorial? He'd never been in a city or a town that didn't have a Civil War Memorial. And most Yankees don't really think of them, but we do have them up here.
We do have them, and often they're a little disguised. There'll be a sort of general to all wars, it's all veterans memorial, but with a figure that's very much wearing a Civil War uniform.
What's their intention? What's their ideological purpose?
So it's very interesting to me that the pose of that soldier on Union Northern monuments is almost always identical to the Southern ones. Again, the low-ranking unnamed soldier. Often the same companies would be mass producing these monuments, and they would just sort of change the details of the cap or the initials on the belt from Confederate States to USA to distinguish the two. Again, stressing of obedience, you know, don't go thinking that you have too much power to run the country, even though you saved the Union. And what I go more into in the book for these Northern memorials is looking about absences. A huge percentage of African American men volunteered for the Union, were living in the North, or because they'd escaped from the South and then volunteered to go back and fight. But only in a vanishingly small number of Northern Union memorials is the existence of Black soldiers acknowledged at all. Most usually you see some Black figure kind of crouching in ragged clothing with begging hands, reaching up to receive the Emancipation Proclamation as if freedom was a gift and not something that they fought for. So this sort of positioning of Black Americans as having this uneasy position in between kneeling and standing very much was an argument for what was thought to be their proper role in America. Sure, they're citizens, but not exactly equal. You know, they should know their place instead of priding themselves on their contribution to the Union.
It's interesting though, that the commonness of these ordinary soldiers may seem on first glance to be a democratic gesture, but in fact, it's about the opposite. It's about subordination.
Yeah, and I think monuments are very good at hiding these messages underneath this very placid facade, and you really have to start poking around and asking questions about who is this really for and what is the message that really lies underneath.
Maybe it's time to go around and pull down some of these Yankee monuments, too. Now, of course, it's not just the Confederacy. There are a lot of Columbus statues that attract attention and have been a target of ire and defacing. Where and why did they pop up and when?
What I found most interesting about researching the protests about Columbus monuments is how far back they have gone. Many protests against Columbus monuments started in the 70s, if not before, and have happened annually on Columbus Day since then, especially in places with large urban Native American populations like the Twin Cities in Minnesota. They have long been asking for these statues to be removed or modified or with information added to acknowledge Columbus's role in damage done to indigenous populations. But it turns out that there is just no procedure for hearing these complaints in most jurisdictions. Across the U.S., there are either laws that protect monuments that really keep them nailed to their pedestals, or the lack of procedure for making complaints basically results in the same thing. If there's no way to process a petition for removal, it ends up in the circular file, thrown away. So one of my chapters, I profile a indigenous activist named Mike Porcha, who pulled down a statue of Columbus in the Twin Cities in 2020. And it turns out that after it was down, the city government acknowledged, yeah, we've been getting his petitions, but we haven't been doing anything with them because there's no procedure.
But then the prosecutor ended up giving a speech, basically, that sounded like, could have been delivered at one of the anti-Columbus rallies.
Yeah, there's a really interesting communal justice, restorative justice approach taken to that. Oh, but you asked how the Columbus went up, which is also a really interesting process because they mainly went up only after the gates of immigration from Italy were closed. So after there was a lot of Italians who had immigrated to America, but there couldn't be a whole lot more. There's a quota system put in place in the early 20th century. And so attention turned from debating about how many people should be allowed into the country to debating how best the new immigrants could be turned into Americans. And in the late 19th century, the very early 20th century, Italians were classified basically as colored, as inferior, as non-Aryan, non-Northern European types. And so a couple of Italian American activists basically had this brain flash of, wait, we can say we're like Columbus, that we have already made a contribution to America. And Columbus is our way into being considered as white. So if you look at these Columbus statues, they look very Northern European in physiognomy because they are part of this argument in the 20s and 30s of, hey, accept us. We're just as European of heritage as all of you Brits and German of Americans, et cetera. So both the people putting up these statues and the people protesting them were reacting to not being considered fully American or even fully human, but in very different ways.
Okay, now, these statues, there's still a lot of them up. They're not all going away. And then there are people who say, well, leave them up as conversation pieces to stimulate historical reflection. Not a predilection Americans are known for, but I guess we could hope for the best. Or put up competing monuments that would distract attention or tell a different kind of story. What do you say to that? Should we remove them or take those other routes?
Well, what I tried to do in the book was question all of the easy answers that I saw people trying to offer to these debates because there are no easy answers. So I found a researcher, Laura Jane Smith, who has been studying people's reactions to monuments and historic sites for decades by conducting in-depth interviews with visitors to see what they actually get from monuments and from the signage on monuments, and particularly signage that attempts to question established historical points of view. And she essentially found that people either just do not pay attention at all to things that they don't want to pay attention to, like visitors to presidential sites are real good at ignoring information about the slaveholding of these presidents, or they will twist that information in a way that doesn't cause cognitive dissonance, that fits it into their pre-existing points of view about those presidents. So her book has great slash horrifying quotes from people saying, oh, now I've learned that, Andrew Jackson really gave enslaved people a chance. He let them work to better their conditions. Like, what fantasy land are you living in? Oh, you just want to continue to regard Jackson as a hero and not have to think about the more complicated pieces of his life. So to make a long story short, it's very complicated to get people to change their minds, especially when they're looking at something that is designed to draw you in, designed to make your heart thrill with patriotic pride, or designed to make you think, ugh, this is too boring to think more about. I won't question what I'm being told. So to change a monument takes a whole lot more than just adding a couple of signs.
These monuments are not mere symptoms. They actually do shape the way we think to some degree. They embody what the culture thinks is important. So there's because symptom is too weak a word for describing what they are. But on the other hand, like removing them or covering them over, whatever you want to do, doesn't really change the underlying social relations. How much of a contribution is monument removal to the transformation of underlying social relations?
Exactly. I think that removing a monument without having a communal conversation about why it's going down is worse than having it up, because that just denies that there ever was a problem with that monument or what it represented. So I am almost strangely glad for all of the delays and controversies about taking down monuments, because I think if we just snapped our fingers and put in a different set of monuments, we would lose a real opportunity to talk about the way our past has shaped our future.
That was Erin Thompson, Associate Professor of Art Crime at John Jay College, and author of Smashing Statues, just out from Norton. You can find her on Twitter as ArtCrimeProf, which is also the URL for her website, artcrimeprof.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Béla Bartók's Divertimento for Strings, first movement, performed by the Chicago Symphony under Pierre Boulez. Next, the far right, which is often very difficult to tell from the respectable right. John Huntington, a professor of history at Houston Community College, is the author of Far Right Vanguard, The Radical Roots of Modern Conservatism, published last fall by the University of Pennsylvania Press. As I often admit, I was briefly a right-winger in my youth, a member of the Party of the Right at Yale. We tried hard to be respectable, but we also had monarchists and Randians among us, and slavery apologist John C. Calhoun, whom the historian Richard Hofstadter dubbed the Marx of the master class, was revered by many. The boundary between respectable and deplorable was always porous. Here's John Huntington with more. What do we mean by conservatism? You know, you mentioned that William Buckley, I mean, there's this kind of image of the Ivy League, port-drinking, leather-wing chairs kind of conservatism. And then there's also, you know, the Christian fundamentalist conservatism. And sometimes they like to keep, or at least the respectable right likes to keep the deplorables at a distance. But it's much more porous than that, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. And I think that porous nature of it is very important, that the kind of pragmatists or the moderates or what you say, the respectables, try to keep the deplorables at an arm's length. But they also want the energy that those so-called deplorables bring to the party or to the movement. And so my book in particular focuses on a group that I call the far right. Back in older history books, they might call them the radical right. The way that I view this group is, if you look at the right wing half of the political spectrum, the far right is kind of wedged in the middle there between the moderates or the pragmatists who kind of lean closer to the center, and then the extreme on the very far right of the scale, you know, people who are willing to commit violence essentially to make their point heard. This far right has a lot of different attributes that I think kind of make them up. So we have, they're anti-statist, right? So they don't like the federal government at all. They think that the federal government is constantly encroaching on their liberties and their freedoms. But it's a strategic anti-statism, because they will also at times use the federal government to further their own conservative ideals. And so they're anti-statist usually only when the liberals are in power. Anti-liberalism is a key component here, that this is a very reactionary movement that is trying to peel back the advance of liberalism. You know, and the origin story of like the New Deal is kind of a big deal for these guys. Oftentimes they draw from the ranks of kind of evangelicals and fundamentalists. You have white supremacists involved here, people who either directly via the segregationist movement or indirectly through like taxation or like voting policies. One of the things perhaps that marks the far right more than other versions of the conservative movement is how puritanical they are with their beliefs, that they have this binary view of the world that is divided into enemies and friends. And so there's like true conservatives, of course, themselves. And then there's communists or other enemies, these others that they're constantly fighting against. And we see this kind of echoed today in the accusations of rhinos, right? Republicans in name only, the idea that they're not pure enough to be real Republicans or real conservatives. And so there's this like sense of aggrievement and betrayal that drives the far right, and I would argue a large portion of the conservative movement.
Going back to the topic of the porosity between the respectables and the deplorables, I mean, William Buckley himself, you know, made a big deal out of policing that border, keeping the Birchers at a distance, and when he founded National Review, even trying to keep the crazies out of the movement, as he defined it. But on the other hand, he supported segregation, and he said some, you know, terribly racist things back in the 50s and 60s. Back in the late 80s, Spy magazine published an article by someone who'd interned at National Review and who recounted some luridly racist conversations he'd heard there, including Dartmouth professor Jeffrey Hart saying, "Under a proper government, Bishop Tutu would be a cake of soap." That distinction, on close examination, is hard to sustain, isn't it?
I do think it does fall apart sometimes. That the way that I kind of look at it is that there's these overlapping Venn diagrams or kind of a gradient on the right. Buckley's issue was that he wanted the conservative movement to be respectable because people like Buckley and others on the right saw the conservative movement as on the outside looking in. They thought that liberalism was this big behemoth and they were trying to fight their way. They were trying to slay the dragon, so to speak. And so he felt like he needed to draw a line to gatekeep between himself and the respectable portions of the movement and the so-called, you know, radical right. But you're correct that sometimes those boundaries blurred to the point of illegibility, you know, truly. Buckley very much was a racist. Revilo Oliver, who was one of the book reviewers at National Review, was a ardent anti-Semite. I think eventually he finally got fired in the early 60s. You know, but yeah, so a lot of the things that Buckley might critique the far right for, he himself holds those beliefs. But I what he's trying to do is put on a public face, a veneer of respectability for the movement as a whole.
Now, a central fantasy, and I use the word mainly, both in the psychoanalytic and the colloquial senses, of the far right is an imminence of a communist threat. And they're still using this today. You know, you see, I don't know, who is it, Marjorie Taylor Greene going on about how big corporations are communists now. So the slightest reform to them represents the first steps down the road to serfdom. So I guess this goes back probably earlier, but the New Deal really set them off. How did Roosevelt or the New Deal really energize them?
I do think the New Deal is very much the origin story of kind of our modern depiction of conservatism because, you know, Roosevelt comes in, he wins a landslide election in 1932, comes in with this very popular mandate in 33 just to get things done. And he and Congress start passing all these laws and literally just create out of almost thin air this welfare state. These protections for workers, Social Security, all these great jobs programs that were happening at the time. And conservatives in both parties, both Republicans and the Democrats, looked at this and, you know, were aghast. The conservative Democrats thought that FDR was debasing their beloved party for various reasons. Some of them were concerned about the growth of the state. Many of them, Southern Democrats, were worried about non-whites getting access to federal dollars, right? Getting government jobs. That was a big concern, particularly for people who owned like ranches or plantations. You know, they didn't want the federal government offering better pay to black laborers, for example. So the conservatives in the 1930s and into the 40s saw FDR and the New Deal as this overwhelming federal power that was a slippery slope to communism. And from that point forward, much of the conservative movement has been based around the idea of slowly chipping away at the legacies of the New Deal. Thus far, they have never been able to get rid of Social Security, for example, but that has not necessarily stopped them from trying or from finding other ways to erode the legacy of the New Deal. So absolutely, Roosevelt and the New Deal, I think, are like I said, the origin story of our modern conservative movement.
Now, it wasn't just, you know, these kind of far-right loons in the anti-FDR crowd, but very respectable businessmen, right? It was an example of that, the respectables and the deplorables traveling in concert.
Yes, absolutely. In the 1930s, there were a lot of businessmen who, large industrialists who fought against Roosevelt. One of the most famous examples happened during World War II in Montgomery Ward. There was a chairman of Montgomery Ward named Sewell Avery. And during World War II, the federal government asserted the right to take over industries that they thought that were necessary for the war effort. And they asserted that power over Montgomery Ward. And Sewell Avery basically said no. And so FDR, he didn't do it directly, but some of his underlings basically sent in the military and literally carried Sewell Avery out. There's a great picture in the front page of numerous newspapers of Sewell Avery with his arms crossed being carried out by soldiers, you know, who have their helmets and their rifles on and stuff. And so it's for kind of libertarian business owners, you know, Sewell Avery was a hero. But, you know, and so very much that there was definitely an element of businessmen and, you know, the industrialist kind of movement that was anti-FDR as well. You know, these were not just conspiracy theorists on the fringes.
Now, there were also some domestic fascists who were in sympathy with Hitler and Mussolini. How big were they and how did they relate to the somewhat more respectable anti-New Deal forces?
Yeah, so there definitely was a domestic fascist movement, the German-American Bund, led by Fritz Kuhn and some other guys, the Silver Shirts of this era. So they have kind of a complex legacy because there were large-scale rallies held for a German-American Bund, which was essentially kind of like the Nazi Party brought over to America, and they held big rallies in like Madison Square Gardens where tens of thousands of people attended. Now, most of the guys that I study kept those people at an arm's length out of either a sense of respectability or just a sense that that wasn't the direction that the guys I study wanted to go. You know, the people that I study were more in the 30s, like the Jeffersonian Democrats, more so Southern Democrats who were angry about the New Deal and the direction that it was taking, as opposed to really agreeing with the fascists. For example, when I think it was William Dudley Pelley ran for president in 1944 under a party called the Christian Party, I believe, and he only got like 1,200 votes. The fascists did have numbers, and they were more, I would say, numerous than people in our modern day would think they were. But they, I don't think that they did not represent the larger portion of the conservative movement at the time.
Now, because of the overwhelming popularity of the New Deal and the fact that the crash and the Depression had so discredited the right, the business class, they were really fighting a losing battle in the 30s. And then through the war, when it would be really hard to challenge the president who is leading the country in a world war. But coming out of the war, how did the forces of this far right mobilize after peace came and the Depression didn't return?
The onset of the Cold War is really, really important because America goes from World War II to essentially being right in the Cold War almost immediately. And so by the late 1940s, communism is now enemy number one for the American government and for the American people. And anti-communism really provide kind of a unifying force for conservatives because communism created enemies both foreign and domestic. You have the Soviet Union, of course, who is the enemy of the whole country. But then conservatives would look internally and see communism everywhere in the civil rights movement, in churches that were more ecumenical, just Democrats were accused of being communists, of course. And so the Cold War really provided was a catalyst for the far right because it enabled them to say all these concerns that we've had about communism coming to America are now coming to fruition. And the Cold War almost gave them legitimacy because other people in America, non-far right, regular people were concerned about communism too. And so when these guys start talking about it and fear-mongering about it, they have a listening audience who is also attuned to these concerns.
People like McCarthy and HUAC and all that were disreputable in some circles. But on the other hand, that anti-communist, all that Red Scare stuff, did enable the purging of the unions of all their communist radicals. So it actually performed, from the mainstream's point of view, a useful service to have these rabid dogs. And then you can cast them aside as they've done their work. But they were pretty useful to the overall political economy.
That's right. And you know, Martin Dies Jr. And HUAC also targeted New Deal programs for, you know, with accusations of communism. So in a way, this is kind of one of those porous boundaries between like the anti-statism, but also the usage of state power. You know, conservatives were willing to use things like congressional investigations to go after liberal targets, as you mentioned, labor unions, you know. And so there's this it's this paradox that on one hand, conservatives say they are against the growing of the federal government, the enlarging of the federal government, but at the same time are willing to use that power when it suits their purposes.
I think you said about George Wallace, he wanted more police, more soldiers, but less government.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
A paradox that haunts the right today still. I'm speaking with the historian John Huntington, author of Far Right Vanguard, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. In the 50s, the right wing hated Eisenhower Republicanism. He was a sellout. He was everything they hated, and there was some organizing against it. Pretty quiet, pretty small at that point. But, how was the Eisenhower, the anti-Eisenhower forces, how were they organized? What were they up to?
Yeah, so Eisenhower was viewed, very much as a liberal Republican, part of the problem, right, as part of this liberal consensus that was going on in the 1950s. And so hardline conservatives viewed him as the problem. And so what they start doing is creating a large network of organizations, publications, and leaders that are going to all be kind of interconnected and talk to one another in an effort to try to build a legitimate, or what they viewed as a legitimate, conservative movement. And these guys come from all over the country. You know, there's the Conservative Society of America in New Orleans. There's the Liberty Amendment Committee out in Los Angeles, you know, and of course the Birchers were stationed up in Massachusetts, and there are others. They weren't necessarily organizing around an anti-Eisenhower principle, but they did view Eisenhower as part of the problem. And in 1956, we see a clear example of this when a bunch of these far right groups get together and put forth a third party candidate, T. Coleman Andrews, under the banner of the American Independent Party. And Andrews had actually worked in Eisenhower's administration as the country's leading tax man. And then he left government and wrote this piece in the Washington Post that was like, I actually don't like taxes. And the right kind of embraced him as one of their own. And he won, I think, 100,000 votes in 1956. Clearly nothing that's going to shake the big parties, but it was kind of a warning shot to come that these right-wingers are organizing and starting to kind of dip their toe into electoral politics.
Yeah, I think Hofstetter quotes a woman whose comment on Eisenhower's re-election in 56 was 4 more years of socialism.
yeah, exactly.
That's the worldview of those characters. You characterize Billy James Hargis, who's one of these critters, and Christian fundamentalism is a very important part of this movement. You characterize his ideologies, evangelical fundamentalism, anti-communism, and white supremacy. You know, it seems sometimes, and I get this impression reading throughout your book, that not that much has changed on the right in the last 60 or 70 years. They still have the same set of obsessions, only they're much bigger now than they were then.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason why I wanted to write the book that I wrote, is because I wanted to kind of draw these connections between these far-right actors in the 50s and 60s to the modern day. Oftentimes, historians have a tendency to kind of minimize the people that exist on the far right. By minimizing the far right, what it did was it created a false impression of what conservatism was really about. And yeah, a lot of the aggrievements, the anger, the white supremacy of the far right, the conspiracy theories, those things still very much linger. And I think that, you know, in my book, I call Trump kind of he's the apotheosis of the far right, the culmination of it. In many ways, I think that still holds true.
Well, you know, they had Brown v. Board of Education in the mid-50s, and now we've got critical race theory. It's the same set of obsessions, but only now the it seems like it's a much larger scale of opposition.
That's right. And I think the opposition, the scale seems larger because conservatives have made inroads into political legitimacy. I mean, you know, after the Reagan Revolution in 1980, you get basically since then, I would argue that the political pendulum has swung to the right. And it has never really left that right wing area, because even Bill Clinton ran as a relatively conservative Democrat. Obama's signature, the Affordable Care Act, was based on a right wing think tank's idea of what we should do with healthcare. And so, to me, as we have been in this conservative age for the last, you know, four decades now, the conservative movement, I think, has unveiled itself kind of over the last few years.
Now, you talk about these figures who are translators, who sort of mediate between the very far right and the more respectable right. Buckley was one of those. But Barry Goldwater, a very important figure along those lines as well, he straddled the respectable, deplorable boundary. How did he figure into the growth of the right? I mean, he's marginal in 1960. He got crushed in the 64 election, but finally won, as the joke goes, in 1980. Yes, what was Goldwater's role in all this?
Yeah, Goldwater was really important, a critical figure for the rise of the right. And you're right, he started off as an Arizona senator, seen as definitely a warhorse for hardline conservatism. The thing is, the far right always saw him as one of their own. In 1960, there was a small movement to get Goldwater on the Republican ticket in 1960. The far right is helping to push that. And then in 64, the far right, I would argue, really is what gets Goldwater on that ticket. They have all the grassroots energy in their favor. At the Republican convention in San Francisco, there were John Birch Society members, dozens of them on the floor acting as delegates. You know, and so the far right really helps push Goldwater into the spotlight as the champion of conservative values. And I think his book, Conscience of a Conservative, went a long way towards this, right? Which was ghostwritten by Brent Bozell, William F. Buckley's relative. And so
they co-wrote a defense of McCarthy too, right?
That's correct. Yeah. McCarthy and his enemies. Yeah. A defense of McCarthy and his witch hunting. Absolutely. Conservatives still believe today that McCarthy was done wrong and that McCarthy was actually correct, you know, and that the Senate was wrong to censor him. And so a lot of those things, you know, those agreements that are almost like old grudges, like still hold true today. But yeah, Goldwater, so, so important for establishing conservatism, I think, as a legitimate political movement. Even though he got crushed in 64, I think it was that signal that this is a movement that has clear direction. And I think maybe most importantly, it showed where the tide was going, in that the Republican Party was now definitively the party of conservatism, whereas in previous generations, it was Eisenhower and these liberal conservatives or these modern Republicans, whereas Goldwater signals this shift to where the Republican Party is now clearly the party of conservatism going into the future, and the Democrats are going to be the party of liberalism going into the future.
Well, then, of course, there was Nelson Rockefeller, too, the target of hatred at the 64 convention.
That's right. Literally got drowned out in booze.
Now, your book closes, not quite. You do have an epilogue which goes past this, but you know, your book more or less closes with first Goldwater getting crushed and then Wallace getting crushed in 68. The right had some great hopes for Wallace, and then he crashed and burned and ended up with only a small portion of the vote. We were talking earlier, they grew. That was not the end, although everyone thought that was the end. Everyone was writing obituaries for the far right after the 68 election.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so what happened?
No, that's a good question. And one of the things that my book is marked by is generational transitions, because the far right that drove the conservative movement in the 1950s and 60s also is dying off by the time that you really get to Reagan and H.W. Bush. You know, Welch dies in like 83 or 85, you know, and a lot of the guys that I write about don't live long into the 90s. And so, or even if they do, they're very, very old. And so the activist years are kind of behind them. And so this new generation kind of picks up the mantle. One of the things that I found the most interesting was how the ideas that the far right was putting forth back in the 50s and 60s have, you know, made their way. They've snaked their way up to our modern day. And a good example of this is Ron Paul in 2010, when the Tea Party kind of movement was at its peak. Ron Paul put in a bill to get rid of the 16th Amendment.
The 16th Amendment is the income tax.
That's correct, yeah. And it's the literally exact same bill that a guy named Willis Stone wrote in the 1940s and 50s called the Liberty Amendment. And Ron Paul literally just submitted the exact Liberty Amendment as Stone wrote it in 2010. And I actually called Ron Paul and I had an interview with him and asked him, like, well, how did you find this? And he was like, oh, it's just this is the sort of stuff that comes across my desk. and not only is that amazing, but it also I think reveals the long lifespan of these far right ideas, that they don't just disappear into the ether when the leaders of that generation die, but they do linger in kind of the conservative ecosystem, ready for someone to pluck them out and use them again.
And of course now Ron Paul's son is carrying on the struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Liberty Amendment, as it was written back then, said that you would repeal the 16th Amendment and get the federal government out of the economy entirely. So like they would have to, the federal government would have to sell off all like corporations, anything that was run by the federal government would have to be sold off. And so it would amount to basically a massive privatization of everything the federal government did, which would be a huge giveaway to the wealthy.
Finally, you know, these translators you talk about, the ones who intercede between the far right and the merely right, this seems almost quaint today because we've got people like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress, you know, Lauren Boebert, the kinds of things you can flip on the TV and see Fox. People who would be regarded as absolute lunatics 20, 30 years ago with a mainstream platform. How do you view, how does this current configuration look like in the context of your work?
Yeah, I think one of the things that has changed between the 50s era and 60s era versus today, there's a number of things that have changed, but regarding the conservative movement and how people have access to these ideas, one is that the conservative activists who are wealthy, like the wealthy conservative activists, have kind of gotten together as a group. They have funded all these think tanks, and so they're, or started Fox News, and so their ideas are being pushed into the mainstream through respectable outlets. But I think the other thing that has really changed the game, particularly for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and like Lauren Boebert, is just the access that people have through new technologies like the internet. George Nash, the famous scholar of conservatism, and Jennifer Burns of Stanford both wrote pieces about how the internet has removed gatekeepers. There's just no one watching the gate anymore for the conservative movement. And so all the conspiracy theories and this sort of stuff just get mainstreamed, you know, on places like Facebook and Twitter. And so people have, or even just the algorithms that YouTube uses will just push, you know, conspiratorial stuff to your, if you're searching for the right kind of thing, you know, it can drive you down this hole of radicalism. And so I think that that's one of the big game changers, because back in the 50s and 60s, if you wanted to read or learn about conservatism, you had to go to a library and, you know, pick up Road to Serfdom or something.
Yeah, I was just reading about the history of the John Birch Society alongside your book. And they were pushing, in their fading days, they were pushing the Laetril as a cure for cancer. And now we've got, you know, these lunatics pushing ivermectin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That type of grifting is very common. Billy James Hargis, in his he had a periodical called Christian Crusade, and if you look at the advertisements that are interspersed throughout it, some of them come across as a little bit snake oil salesman type stuff.
That was John Huntington, a professor of history at Houston Community College, an author of Far Right Vanguard: The Radical Roots of Modern Conservatism, published last fall by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You can find him on the web at johnshuntington.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. We don't need that fascist groove thing, the classic Heaven 17 song from 1981, covered by Philly Punk's The Dead Milkmen last year. Till next week, bye.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist groove thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass. Unlock that mighty chain gang. Brothers, sisters, shoot your back. We don't need this fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Camouflage won't do no good. U.S., I feel your power. Hitler proved that funny stuff. It's not for you and me, girl.
No, 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 no.
They've had the fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing.